You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
African-American players dominate the sport of basketball. LeBron James and Kobe Bryant are among the most celebrated athletes in the world, and Michael Jordan remains a superstar many years after he's retired. But when the NBA was founded in 1949, 2 years after Jackie Robinson integrated Major League Baseball, there was not a single African-American on any roster. In his latest film, Black Magic, Dan Clarris tells the story of the pioneering players and coaches who eventually broke down those racial barriers, an aspect of the civil rights movement that's often overlooked. And I'm very pleased to welcome Dan Clarris back to our show. Hi.
Hello. Thank you so much.
Your film opens with a game played in secret. In 1944, Coach John McClendon led his team from the North Carolina College for Negroes against one of the leading college powers of the day, the all-white team from Duke. Duke remains a major power. How did the game go?
The North Carolina College for Negro guys beat them 88-44.
Double. They doubled the score. Why did it have to be secret?
It was against the law. The game was to play in an integrated atmosphere. It was against the law throughout the South. And the game was played on a Sunday in Durham because most people were in church. There were only two referees and a scorekeeper allowed, no fans, no media.
Well, Duke had to be a pretty good team. It was the top team in the country, wasn't it?
They were a top team, mostly returning veterans from the war, and they were older. Most of the black players had never even spoken to, touched, or had any communication with a white player before, ever.
So was it a matter of just having different styles of play?
The style of play, and this was from – my film is about historical black colleges and basketball and the civil rights movement. The style of play was to run and fast break. And McClendon, who was one of the thinkers and shapers of the fast break, not given the credit for, his teams were to average 97 points a game when other teams were averaging 62 a game. The black players just – outran them. However, that type of basketball, well into the 1960s, was referred to by many people as jungle ball. And if you look at teams now, well, of course, they're run and gun. Mike D'Antonio shoots every 7 seconds. Well, that's what McClendon, who learned the game from Naismith, was preaching in the 40s.
What did he learn from Naismith, who wanted a very different kind of game? He wanted a game in which there was no contact.
But McClendon actually was a student of Naismith's at the University of Kansas in the 30s. He's half Cherokee, half black, McClendon, and he went to Kansas to learn from Naismith.
Well, he's been called the godfather of black college basketball. But how much was the lopsided victory due to the style of North Carolina and his team, and how much was it due to the quality of his players?
It was both. It was once the anxiety and nervousness left the players, they ran them out because they played a vital game. They played an energetic game. It was a different game. People were not using the fast break. McClendon actually also created what we know as now the four corners offense, generally accredited to Dean Smith or a guy named Danny Moe. But McClendon created the four corners. They called the jack in the box a two in a corner then. He was a head coach at 27. He was a brilliant thinker and teacher. Over 500 wins in his career and influenced many, many, many people.
But the reason I ask you that is I wonder if those players on his team would have been stars on teams like Duke if segregation hadn't prevented it, or would they not have thrived in the style of play that Duke then practiced?
It's a good question. They had the ability and the intelligence to be stars. Whether the systems of the white schools, which we call majority schools, would have allowed them to play, I doubt it. The proof of that is when the NBA opened its doors to the black player in 1950, the black player, up until Elgin Baylor came into the league, was limited in what he could do. Even if he could shoot, run, jump, He was told, fill the lanes, get the rebounds, box out, play defense. No personal playing, no one-on-one playing.
And you say that that really affected the career of someone like Cleo Hill.
Well, Cleo Hill, a lot of things affected his career. He was, before Earl Monroe, the greatest player in the history of historical black colleges at Winston-Salem State. He's from Newark. He played for Big House Gaines. He was the first round draft pick of the St. Louis Hawks in 1960, and he averaged about 24 a game during the exhibition season. St. Louis was a racist city at the time, and the team had a number of Southern whites on them, and the owner, Ben Kerner, demanded that Cleo Hill sit on the bench because the white Southern players, some of whom are quite famous.
Like Bob Pettit, we're talking about?
Pettit was the third, but the egregious ones were Cliff Hagan mostly, and to a smaller extent, Clyde Lavellet. But they wouldn't play Cleo, and he was blacklisted from the league, completely never allowed to play an NBA game again.
And we're talking about 10 years after the game had been integrated.
10 years after the game. Well, there was a quota system. A quota system throughout the league. At first, some teams were allowed to have one black player. Many teams couldn't have any. Then eventually two. Even by the time that Earl Monroe got into the league in 1967, the quota was 6-6. You couldn't have more than six blacks.
When did the first black players begin to play for the Division I schools?
There were some players in the late 1930s that would play for Division I schools, mostly the Catholic schools, Duquesne, and in the Midwest, Xavier, Iowa. But the influx, and it was obviously all based around economics, the influx really started happening with the when kids like Elgin Baylor, Oscar Robinson, Bill Russell, and Wilt Chamberlain in the mid to late 1950s. Then a light went off and to some coaches and said, well, we could win. We could win.
Did coaches like McClendon get to play in the division? Coach in the Division I schools as well?
McClendon won three national championships in a row, 1957 through 59, at what we call Tennessee State, with Dick Barnett, the great former Knick. They were only allowed to play in the NAIA. The NCAA would not allow the black schools. The NIT would not allow the black schools. McClendon won the three consecutive national championships, and 5 years later, he became the first African-American ever to coach an integrated school at Cleveland State. 4 years before that, he became the first African-American ever to coach a professional basketball team in the ABL, the Cleveland Pipers, owned by a young 31-year-old shipping magnate named George Steinbrenner.
McClendon also had a hand in the Washington Capitals' decision to draft Harold Hunter, who was the first African-American to sign a contract with the NBA, and of Earl Lloyd, the first African-American to play in an NBA game. Why aren't their names as familiar to us as Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby?
Well, it goes into the issue of baseball truly being a more popular sport around this country than basketball. Baseball is outdoors, accepted throughout the country. I think that's it. I mean, economics back up that statement. The media covered it, and Earl Lloyd and Harold Hunter are still with us, and they're wonderful men, and they played against each other a lot in college.
My guest is Dan Clures, whose film Black Magic was aired this summer on ESPN. Now it's available as a two-DVD set. After the big Division I schools like North Carolina, Kansas, and Duke began to recruit talented black players, didn't the historically black colleges find that they couldn't recruit the same caliber of players they had relied on in the past?
Yes. Well, that's always the argument, and it supersedes just mere basketball. Once majority institutions began to accept the African-American student, be it sports or not, the historical black colleges in this country are in dire financial straits now. So basketball is one thing that the competitive level is not the same at all.
Are any players from schools like Fisk, Winston-Salem, Southern University being drafted into the NBA today?
No. I think there are three or four players from historical black colleges in the NBA today. None of them are stars. Two of them are old. Darrell Armstrong And forgive me, I forget the last one. The Knicks had a guy, but everyone in New York wanted him out, which is Jerome James. They're not, you know what? They'd be wise to have a couple of kids from those schools because they'd be great teammates. They don't fit into the stereotype of the selfish NBA player.
Yeah. You talk about some other coaches here. You mentioned Clarence Big House Gaines. There's also Ben Jobe. Did they coach pretty much the same way that McClendon did?
Yes, they both learned the game from McClendon. Big House Gaines won over 800 games at Winston-Salem State. And Ben...
800 games, that's got to be close to one of close to the record,
isn't it? He was second to Adolph Rupp. I think he won 813 games. And they used to call him Big House and Little House, McClendon being the little house. He's only 5'7". So Gaines was a great coach. And Ben Jobe coached at six historical black colleges and universities. He learned the game from McClendon. He won 524 games. And he's a 77-year-old scout for the New York Knicks right now.
There are some who argue that the game has become too much about showboating in recent years, that players have sacrificed knowledge of the basics for the ability to make the big dunk or make the fancy behind-the-back pass. Is that part of this story?
In a subtle way, it's part of the story. But I agree with that statement, though, and I think that kids are learning all the wrong lessons playing the game on the AAU level now, and even in colleges. And it's all about television, and they refer to it as old school. But there's only one way to play the game, says Larry Brown, and that's the right way.
The Negro Leagues of Baseball have become part of the popular culture and history, and the Hall of Fame has instituted a whole section that honors the players. Why hasn't that happened with the all-black basketball players?
For 2 years, and one of the points of Black Magic is that because it's a film about exclusion and therefore invention, for 2 years we've been in the middle of a battle to get the Hall of Fame to open its doors to players and coaches from historical black colleges. And for 2 years, there's a lot of lip service. They haven't done it yet. These men and women, many of them have already passed on. Most of them are elderly. They deserve it. And there's something wrong with an institution like the Hall of Fame, who today announces that they're opening up a Michael Jordan Nike exhibition in the Hall of Fame, and they still have this door shut to all of these men and women who deserve it.
One of the big shockers in your film is the story of Bob Love. Many people will remember him as a kid who overcame all sorts of problems. He had worked. He was one of 14 children, worked in the cotton fields from the age of eight, endured poverty, domestic abuse. He had a serious stuttering problem. And then he became a superstar with the Chicago Bulls after not even being drafted, if I remember correctly. After he was out of the game, was not able to rest on his laurels.
Well, you know, people are afraid of people who are different, who have a disability, who have a disease. Bob Love, since a child, had such a severe stutter that people thought he was stupid. He wasn't stupid at all. So he had a rough life, and his old teammates at the Chicago Bulls, who became coaches, they wouldn't give him a chance. Finally, after he was a busboy in a local cafeteria, he built his life back up together. And now, amazingly, he gives 300 motivational speeches a year, a guy that couldn't talk.
Because he's stopped stuttering. He's learned how to get past that.
He's learned how to get past it. That's right.
So tell me about the DVD sets. Available in stores?
Yeah, they're available in stores and on Amazon. You know, we're lucky. The film won the Peabody, which is great. And, I'm hoping that it opens everyone's eyes to historical black colleges and what a great contribution they've made to America in all different ways, not merely sport.
And now you're making a new film, this time about something that's going to cause me great pain, Reggie Miller versus the Knicks.
Yeah, it comes out in March on ESPN. It's part of their 30 on 30 series called Winning Time, Reggie Miller versus the New York Knicks. And it may have a happy ending for Knicks fans, but
there's never a happy ending for Knicks fans, not for many years.
It's going to be a it's going to be a journey to appreciate the ending, you know. But it's a comedy. I'm doing it as a comedy, and I'm having a lot of fun making that movie.
Dan Clark, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.